There's a lot of information that we've talked about in the past about Brian Koberger concerning the murders on King Road, but in the months leading up to that appalling massacre that would send shivers down the spine of anyone who hears about it, Brian Koberger, a seemingly ordinary student at Washington State University, allegedly engaged in other disturbing chains of actions. As detailed in a recent report, this chronicle of events is not for the faint of heart. We'll go through it, and then Stacy and myself will discuss what we now have learned more about Brian Koberger. Our story begins with Brian Koberger allegedly engaging in a pernicious fixation on a female classmate. This fixation would soon escalate to outright stalking, a series of actions that, unbeknownst to her, would lay the foundation for a chilling ruse that would give his unprecedented access into her life. The ruse involved Koberger cunningly installing surveillance cameras in the woman's home, in a story that almost seems too far-fetched to believe, yet, unfortunately, it's real. A seemingly innocuous act, yet it afforded him the opportunity to remotely observe her living space at any given moment. An unsettling violation of her privacy that no one could have anticipated. Upon hearing the details of this invasive break-in and covert camera installation, Carrie Rawson, the daughter of the infamous serial killer Dennis Rader and a victim's advocate, shared her perturbing thoughts with Fox News Digital. Rawson, well acquainted with the progressive nature of such predators due to her father's history, considered this behavior as a significant escalation indicative of Koberger's guilt. She voiced her thoughts on an NBC report that aired on Dateline, drawing attention to the disturbing parallels between her father's and Koberger's actions. The report further delved into a peculiar incident that occurred just a few houses away from the King Road home, involving a woman's intimate apparel. The unsettling event took place just a few months before the infamous University of Idaho murders took place. The report most chillingly suggests that even Koberger's own family members feared his potential involvement, a revelation that sent spine ripples of dread through their holiday gatherings. These suspicions culminated in a swift early morning raid on December 30th of 2022, leading to Koberger's arrest for the horrifying murders of Madison Mogan, Kaylee Gonsalves, Zaina Kernodal, and Ethan Chapin, all between the ages of 20 and 21. Takes us back to the female friend whom Koberger had met at his criminology program at Washington State University. One day, she found her home disturbed, her belongings shuffled out of their regular places. However, nothing was missing, prompting her not to report the incident to authorities. In a twist of fate, she sought Koberger's assistance. Remember, Koberger at this time was not the Koberger that we know today. He was just a criminology student, doing some assistant teaching here and there and attending classes and being his overall weird self, who had previous experience as a security guard and a master's degree in criminal justice. He said, well, I'll help you set up a home surveillance system. Koberger, always, however, within the range of the woman's Wi-Fi, reportedly had access to the cameras, offering him an invasive and disturbing window into her personal life. Koberger's study in criminal justice under the direction of Catherine Ramsland, an expert in the psychological analysis of serial killers and mass murderers, eerily mirrors the academic path of Dennis Rader, also known as BTK for bind, torture, kill. Rader, too, was a student of criminal justice and later employed by ADT, Home Security Company. Drawing upon these overlapping similarities, Rawson suggested that Koberger's alleged break-in, subsequent offer to install a security system, and then accessing the system clandestinely indicated a descent further along the scale of deviant behavior, a disturbingly familiar echo of her father's sexual sadistic psychopathy. Ted Williams, a lawyer, a former homicide detective, conveyed his concerns about the alarming report. He stressed the importance of DNA evidence, Koberger's phone data, any additional evidence that the police could have seized from the suspect's vehicle parked at his parents' home in Pennsylvania for the case. Williams offered a significant insight, noting that physical evidence might well be hidden within innocuous spaces like a seatbelt compartment, an area Koberger likely wouldn't consider cleaning. Authorities, he said, would undoubtedly focus on such areas during their investigation. The opinion was echoed by John Kelly, a seasoned criminal profiler and psychoanalyst renowned for his experience in interviewing mass murderers. As he stated, when the day comes for Koberger to face courts and trial, which was highly likely, he would be hard-pressed to explain damning evidence such as the presence of his DNA on a sheath found in a room under one of the victim's bodies. Adding further layers to the unsettling narrative, the report revealed that Koberger's immediate family had become suspicious even before the police began their search for a specific vehicle, a stark indication of the depths of his suspected guilt. It was alleged that one of Koberger's sisters found his behavior during his visit back home to Pennsylvania peculiar enough to link him to the white Elantra previously noted to be close to the November crime scene, making the connection that Koberger was indeed the suspect. Rawson herself, acquainted with the shock of discovering a family member's horrifying secret, empathized with Koberger's family, expressing hope that they had approached law enforcement if they indeed suspected him before his arrest, yet she understood the stark clarity of hindsight, such grave matters. The report indicated that Koberger's relatives even attempted to search his car, only to find it already cleaned up. However, Williams confidently asserted that no amount of cleanup could completely eradicate physical evidence, reassuring everyone that authorities have advanced means and methods to reveal what may have been attempted to be hidden. But what led his sisters to suspect him so intensely? Kelly pondered if the answer might be rooted in Koberger's past, specifically his alleged struggle with drug addiction during high school. It's common knowledge that substance abuse, especially with potent narcotics like heroin, often results in growing antisocial behaviors. Alternatively, it might have been due to a purported contempt for women, known only to his sister. Adding another layer of complexity to the story, Kelly noted that Koberger's sisters worked in the mental health field. Usually, we don't end up there by mistake, he explained, suggesting they might have witnessed some disturbing signs in their brother's behavior earlier. Before the tragic incident that captured him into notoriety, there had been another alarming episode. That woman reported to the Moscow police that her car had been tampered with and underwear was left stuffed in a cup holder. This incident occurred in a student rental neighborhood just 200 yards from the university's Greek Row, which was not an uncommon sight for police visits. Then came the horrifying day when four young students, all in the prime of their lives, were found brutally stabbed to death. The grim report suggested at least some of them were probably sleeping when the dreadful attack began at 4 a.m. Following these terrifying events, Koberger found himself facing Latah County District Judge John Judge, entering a not guilty plea on behalf of his arraignment, noting he did not speak out loud in that arraignment. Currently, he's being held without bail at the neighboring jail awaiting a trial set for early October, although this may be postponed if his right to a speedy trial is waived. So how creepy is it that Koberger, I mean, of all the things, of all the interactions we can learn about him prior to the bad acts occurring, the murders taking place, is him installing a security camera in a co-ed's house and having access to the cameras. I want to
see his computer. I want to see, did he ever make recordings of what these cameras were picking up? Was he doing something with them?
Well, I would imagine a lot of these things, they go to the cloud, so you could easily download them. I'm very curious about the data, because one of the big things that they're talking about as being a giant obstacle in the defense of Koberger is being able to go through like the 52 or 55 terabytes of data that were given to them. And it sounds
huge.
And it is huge. I don't like a lot of the comparisons that are being made on TV because it just makes it sound far more of a monumental task than I think it truly is. You're like, how many pages would that be? We're not talking pages here. Is there some pages on his computer? Sure. But we're talking probably a lot of video because that is a lot of data that really probably is made up of many video files. Now, how many? That depends on the quality of the video that you're saving. But I have software that saves video in very compressed formats where a large hour-long thing can just be a couple hundred megabytes. I have others where if it's uncompressed, it can be terabytes of data for one single file. So I think it sounds ridiculously overwhelming on the surface, but my guess is there's a lot of video here. And I'm curious as to what the video is of.
I wonder why this student felt the need to go to him specifically after she felt that somebody had been in her place and moved her things around, that she felt that he was the one to go to instead of, I don't know, maybe a landlord or a professor or a law enforcement for that matter. Even though nothing was stolen, it was very obvious somebody had been in her home.
I don't know. I mean, the only thing I could say is, you know, everybody's young and dumb at that age. And we all make bad choices. We all make probably more trusting choices than we should sometimes at that age. And if he's your neighbor, he seems pretty peaceful, really hasn't done a whole lot, and he knows about computers. Hey, you know, couldn't you help me? Because, you know, maybe you don't want to talk to the landlord. Maybe you don't want to try and hire a security company because maybe you don't have the money to do any of those sort of things. And if he just seems like a friendly neighbor, I'll help you out. But in the back of his mind, he's like, oh, yeah, she has no idea. I'm going to have access to all these things, too. It was a very easy in for him and her to be very unsuspecting of what that person's ulterior motive really was.
Absolutely frightening, though. I wonder if she is just sitting in a little cocoon in a corner in the basement, rocking back and forth over what might have happened to her.
It makes you wonder, and I don't know if, obviously no one knows but him, if he was targeting her to do more, or if this was more of an exercise in how can I gain access to someone? How can I do this sort of thing in a very voyeuristic sort of way? And it really wouldn't have gone any further than that. But the fact that he likely knew how to do this sort of thing, allegedly, I also wonder about other cameras in the area. I also wonder, you know, what else does he have access to? I know there was a lot of speculation. Well, he was applying to work as, it was beyond the security. I think he was trying to work with one of the police departments. If he would have had access to some of the cameras in the area, the security surveillance systems of the area, that was early speculation. But I believe that was proven that he did not, but he came close. He came close to getting there, just a few steps away to a little more access for someone that, you know, likely did these horrible crimes. Of course, innocent until proven guilty, but just he gets spookier by the day.
Absolutely. And can you imagine if he had worked for one of these security companies and was inside people's homes? And it seems as though he was really targeting women. This was his thing. Mm-hmm. Oh,
well, there's this interesting connection between BTK and him with the professor that he studied under. Granted, he's a very different personality than BTK. He is not Dennis Rader. Mm-mm. But there's a lot of weird parallels, almost like BTK was looked up to as almost a hero, possibly within the mind of Brian Koberger. And I'm curious if he's still playing out that fantasy in court, because BTK, Dennis Rader in court, did the exact same thing that Koberger did the other day when it came to plead. He stood silent. In the end, there was never a BTK trial because it came down the road a little bit further that the death penalty was there, but taken off the table. And he then confessed to everything in court. You remember that horrific testimony where he went into the details of every single murder that he did in great detail in court with not a lot of remorse. I mean, it was more matter of fact, but that was a man who I don't think is capable of remorse or showing those feelings or having those feelings. And what you saw is what you got. And I do wonder if Koberger is sort of like that, because there's an element to his demeanor that does remind me of BTK, of just very almost professional in court. Do you understand this? Yes, I do. Very much, I'm here. I know why I'm here. I know what they're accusing me of. And very methodical, very robotic, if you will. There's not a lot of emotion that we're seeing in anything. But Koberger himself has said through his online writings that we've been covering forever here, how at a young age, about 15, he started to realize he wasn't feeling emotion. He wasn't understanding other people's emotions. He felt very disconnected and really did try and go on a journey of bringing that back. He recognized feeling it at a younger age, and then suddenly it just kind of changed. Why that changed, we don't really know. He doesn't really express anything in those writings about why it changed. Sometimes there's a traumatic event, some sort of trauma may cause that to change. And sometimes people just grow into that and they're missing that. And that is what it is. A lot of people live very happy, productive lives. They have to learn how to mimic others to kind of get by and emote, if you will, because others want to see emotion from other people. Otherwise, it's quite creepy. Others don't. They don't learn it at all. And then they fall into very dark places like this, allowing them to do certain things like this because they don't have the emotion, or the only time they feel something, some little bit of emotion, is when they are carrying out a horrible act like murder.
And that's something that we've heard with a lot of potential criminals, that they'll do these horrific things just to feel something, because their everyday life is just, didn't he say he felt like a sack of meat?
Yes.
Or something. Yeah. That you just, they don't feel emotion. They don't feel those waves of happiness that occur for some of us, you know, and it I don't even know if it's despair that they feel. They feel nothing.
It's nothing.
So,
yeah.
You know, that's why a lot of people will start cutting themselves so they can feel something. Well, in that same analogy, he may have taken that way off the charts to a different level.
You know, that's a good analogy. You know, obviously when one's cutting oneself, they're cutting themselves. But yeah, a lot of people do that for that reason. But there's also people who will then act out in this horrible way and act against others to feel something as well. I'm just wondering, the more we watch this, if this is all part of the ride he signed up to be on, and he knows what's going to happen next, and he's fine with it. I do wonder if we're going to see a trial here, or if in the coming months, especially if death is put on the table, the state has 60 days to decide that now, if we're going to see them come back and say, okay, look, he's going to confess, he's going to say everything, if you can take this off the table, the death penalty. And I think maybe that's the playing card. That's my guess on this. I've talked to a lot of people. Many are saying it really doesn't make much sense as to why he did it. It could be used for a claim of some sort of mental incompetency, which I don't think there's any way he would get in Idaho, considering Lori Vallow Daybell was deemed competent. Brian Koberger is freaking competent compared to that. But I do suspect it has something to do with the death penalty and playing the card of how do you not get killed by the state now? Because if he goes to trial and he's found guilty, he's going to get the death penalty. It's not officially on the table yet, but I think that's what they're expecting. And if there's one way out of that, it would be simply, and that's not guaranteed out of that, the state can still have the death penalty no matter what you do. But if they make that agreement, maybe we'll see him confess. And ultimately, for the families, that's probably what they want more than anything else. Him confessing to the murders, it doesn't bring anybody back, but it also doesn't then continue to put them through legal hell for the rest of their lives if he is in a capital case where he could get the death penalty, and then you have years and years and years and years and years of appeal, and he finally gets offed, you know, when some of these parents are in their 80s, which is pretty much how death row works typically.
Oh, absolutely. It's just an over and over situation where it's the appeal comes up, they get denied, or I mean, it's just, it continues to go on. And you wait how many years before it's actually done, that they actually do put the person to death?
Yeah. I mean, one would almost argue, it's like, if we do the death penalty, it's like, okay, death penalty. Okay, well, sir, we have a chair for you right over here. It's called the electric chair, and you just sit down and we're done. And like, we do it in court before it's adjourned.
Yeah. Well, as long as you've got the right person, that's the one part.
Exactly. And it is interesting because what I find interesting, honestly, specifically about the death penalty in the state of Idaho is the fact that they've had so many screw ups where the cocktail of chemicals that they put into people didn't work right. And now it's to the point of saying, well, if we can't get our hands on the right chemicals, then we can do a firing squad. And I'm cool with either, quite honestly. It doesn't make a difference to me. I actually think the firing squad's probably a little more humane than the chemical way of doing things. But how is it that it's so difficult to come up with a secure way of getting the correct chemicals to kill someone? It seems people are able to do this every single day in their medicine cabinet. Why is it so difficult for the state to come up with a cocktail that's going to kill somebody?
Well, and that's, I come from the veterinary field, and euthanasias, they don't usually typically go wrong. The drugs that they use work successfully. So I know that they would be toxic for humans, because in the veterinary world, you have to be extremely careful with that medication. You don't want to get a needle stick after you've euthanized a pet. You don't want that in your system for those exact reasons, that they will do harm. So the fact that we can find this medication to give to animals to put them to sleep, why is it so hard for us to find it for humans?
What I understand, there's like only one company that was producing it. I don't know. It's probably some sort of weird bureaucratic answer, to be completely honest, at the end of the day, because I mean, we have access to these sort of things. Why is this such a weird sticking point? That one just doesn't make any true sense to me. And the answer is always just like, well, just because that's how it is. No.
Yeah, it sounds like a petulant parent. Yeah. What bothers me about the firing squad is, what kind of trauma are you doing to the people who are pulling the trigger?
Well, I agree with that to a certain extent, but I would almost guess that you sit there and you talk to any of those people who are involved in that, and they're probably not that traumatized.
No, it's probably true. I mean, if you volunteered to be that person, you've put some thought into it, I would think.
And it's usually like a 1 in 5, like one has a bullet, the others are all blanks, and nobody truly knows at the end of the day what it was. I believe it's a shot to the heart is what they do. That would be one thing I'd be like, hit the head. That's more humane. I mean, you're not going to get an open casket anymore, but you know, maybe you forfeited that when you killed somebody.
But that's true.
But I think that would be a quicker way out. I mean, if you get hit in the heart, you're going to be there for a couple minutes.
Hopefully you won't know.
I don't know. I mean, I think you really would be there for a couple minutes. It doesn't mean like your brain stops working. It does eventually, but it's not a, you know, instant your brain's blown out of your head.
No, good point. So, very good point.
I don't know. It's an interesting new chapter in this story of predatory behavior, and I would not be surprised if there is much more of that, that's going to continue to come out in the coming weeks or months as we start to count down towards October, if in fact October ends up being the actual date of the trial. I would not be surprised if this gets pushed back. Jennifer Coffendaffer was on the show earlier, and she said to me, I would not be surprised if this takes 4 years to get to trial.
Oh, my.
So It's happened before. Maybe if we have another pandemic or something in there, that would slow things down a little bit. But
yeah, it would.
I think for the sake of everyone, they just wanted to get on. What do you guys think? You can weigh in on this or any of the cases that we are covering for you. 8885-KILLER is the phone number. 888-554-5537 to weigh in. We may use your comments on a future episode of the program. For Stacey, I am Tony. Stay with us.